this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a BAFTA-winning journalist who's reported from around the world, covering wars and revolutions and exposing corruption. He led the way as an undercover investigative reporter on such issues as migration, child labour, and human medical experimentation, giving a voice to the vulnerable, the poor, and defenceless. He's also a great author, as his new book, Taterland, confirms. Paul Kenyon, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hi, thanks.
Paul, people know you first and primarily as a TV reporter. So how did that side of your career begin?
I had no great yearning to be on television. A lot of people in my industry do. I mean, they get into it because they want to be on television. And it wasn't something I particularly wanted to do. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a journalist. And when I left university, I was a researcher for a Lib Dem MP called Simon Hughes. I used that as a kind of platform to try and get to know people in newspapers and in the media generally, try and work out which bit of the media I wanted to be in. And it was quite interesting. I just wanted to write. And I remember these opportunities kept opening up in things like radio. It was sort of come and I met somebody who worked at the BBC in London. They said, come in and see what you make of it and see if you enjoy it. And all the time, at the back of my mind, I was thinking, I just want to write. I just want to get on with this. But I ended up doing radio, and then I'd done that for a few years, and I was invited to do television. I never pushed to do television at all, but I ended up being invited to do that. And I developed a great interest in doing investigative reporting. So once I'd done that, I think people at the BBC began to think, Paul Kenyon's a nutcase. He will take any risk to get a story. And I think it moved on from there. And when there were perhaps less considerations about reporters' personal safety some 15 or 20 years ago, it developed quite quickly from there. Well, so that was my background. That's how I got into it.
Tell me then about Kenyon Confronts. And what do you think would have been your biggest scoops during that programme?
I mean, it was a really enjoyable programme to do. And it's one of those, it's only when you reflect about it 15 years later that you think, wow, it was fortunate. It was fortunate in the sense that we had reasonably good budgets, which doesn't sound interesting, but it allows you to do a whole host of things you could never normally do, based on undercover filming, secret filming. It was based on getting to know various criminal groups and spending time with them with secret cameras as a different person. So it was acting and journalism and a daredevil stunt here and there. So there were loads of things thrown together which made it quite intoxicating, really. So I suppose, in answer to your question, the most exciting one, the one that people remember most and I talk about most, I suppose, is that we ended up doing a programme about people who fake their own deaths. So this is people, you know, who suddenly decide they need £1 million worth of life insurance, and then a couple of weeks later mysteriously disappear and are pronounced dead. And not only did we find somebody who was supposed to be dead, but the highlight of the programme was we decided we'd go to a place where they kind of specialised in this type of fraud, and that I would fake my own death to see what it was like from the inside, filming some fraudsters, so secretly filming the chain of events. And the place that we chose was Haiti. We found a group that specialised in this, normally for American tourists. They'd done it numerous times. Yeah, I ended up lying in a coffin in a funeral suit in Haiti in a funeral parlour next to a real dead body. And when the act was over on my part, the organisers allowed me to get out and they put the dead body in. And then they had a funeral for the dead person. And I said, you know what's really important? I'd really love to come to this funeral. And obviously for television, they didn't know, but for television, that's really important. I'm there at my own funeral. It's a great moment. But the organisers were saying, no, but I mean, why would you want to? You don't want to be at your own funeral. It's incredibly risky. We don't need you anywhere near there. So they were very resistant to the idea. And then the funeral is one of those that you see in a James Bond film, where they had people in kind of bowler hats and suits with trombones and trumpets. It was absolutely extraordinary. And a big long Cadillac and a procession. And I sort of merged in at the back. So I walked behind, some way behind the coffin. And then they buried it in this Port-au-Prince graveyard. And I watched them sort of shovel it in. And it was a real experience just being in a graveyard in Haiti at that time. I think it was about 2002. And there were sort of basically bits of body parts on the floor and things because people raided the graves. I mean, they weren't fresh, but there were bones and stuff that people had yanked out, old coffins, seeing if there was a bit of a suit or a brooch or a ring or something they could take. So anyway, that was the most memorable one.
You were Panorama's youngest ever reporter. And in 2009, you were named the Royal Television Society Specialist Journalist of the Year for documentaries of the world's most dangerous migration routes across the Sahara Desert into Libya and then onto Europe. Now, that actually gave rise to your first book.
Yeah, it did. It was something that really fascinated me, and I had done from a very young age, actually, about immigration. It was interesting that I'd seen this photo of what looked... It was a really unusual photo on the front page of a newspaper in the UK, and it looked like a sort of bracelet floating on the top of the sea, and you couldn't really get any sort of visual context. You couldn't see how big the bracelet was, but you realised, if you looked really closely, that there were people hanging onto it, and it wasn't a bracelet. It was actually a huge kind of ring on the sea that was, in fact, an industrial tuna fishing net, and that all these people were hanging off it. And I looked at it and I thought, so this is in the middle of the Mediterranean. Where have they come from? There's no boat in sight. It was as if they'd just fallen from the sky. And with further research, obviously, it turned out that these were people whose boat had sunk. They'd come from Libya, which was halfway through this long journey out of Africa. They'd finally been rescued because they'd been spotted by a plane, and they were now in Italy. So I tracked them down, and I just thought, you know, we hear a lot in the news about immigration, mainly negative, and I just wanted to put people, faces, human faces, to the statistics. So I decided if I could find three or four of these guys who'd managed to survive this terrible ordeal, that it would really make a fascinating story. So I did. I tracked them down, and they were living in various sheltered accommodation in Italy. And I remember saying to my wife, this is the most extraordinary story. And if I can't write this story as a book, then I can't write a book. I mean, you have to be able to write this. It was so colourful, because one of the key characters who I write about in that book, I discovered that he'd been brought up by a witch doctor in Ghana. So his uncle, who'd brought him up because his mum and dad had both been killed in a road accident, he'd been brought up by a witch doctor. And he hadn't volunteered this at the beginning. It was quite interesting. So when I first met him, he kept saying, when I said, and what would your uncle who brought you up, what did he do? He would just say, he helped people, he cured them. There was sort of lots of code going on, but he never quite said it. And eventually, sort of the penny dropped. And I said, okay, so he was a witch doctor, a medicine man, and there's nothing wrong with that. So the idea that this guy, this 18, 19-year-old, had come across from Ghana, which is where he'd started off, through poverty. You know, they were economic migrants. They weren't people fleeing war. They were fleeing something else, which is very, very difficult to live with. And that's severe poverty. And he'd come out of Ghana and he'd gone across Burkina Faso and then Niger and then into Libya and then across the Mediterranean and into Europe.
Quite extraordinary. Mm. And you picked up on, I think it was 27 different people and followed their paths.
Yes.
Now, in 2011, you were the first TV journalist to report from both sides of the Libyan conflict, and you won the prestigious Association of International Broadcasters Award. And you come back to Libya, in fact, to look at it in your latest book, Dictatorland.
Yes. I'm a bit of a fan of Libya. It sounds like a trite thing to say, but I'm a fan of the people and the history and the architecture, fascinated by Gaddafi. So I first went there when I was, following the most dangerous migration route. We made contact with the authorities under Gaddafi and said, can we come in? We want to see. We had to sell it to him and say, look, this is obviously a problem for you. You have up 2 million or something migrants at that time on the coast waiting to get out of Libya. So these aren't Libyans, of course. They're people from all over Africa who've got to the coast of Libya and are about to take the next move. Gaddafi, or at least his assistants, his entourage, decided we could go in. And obviously they showed us what we wanted to see, what they wanted us to see, rather. And they took us down to... We went right to the middle of the Sahara and right down to where the Algerian, Niger and Libyan borders all meet. And it was quite extraordinary. And we saw the migrants coming in across the border. That was with Gaddafi's men, who were not alarming and not aggressive and difficult with us. In fact, I'll just tell you a story, because it is quite interesting. Everybody is saying, Gaddafi's men, my God, they're going to be fearsome. And actually, we went up to the border on the first night to wait very, very quietly for the migrants to come across the border. And the idea is you have to sit there absolutely silently, because, of course, there were no sounds in the desert. And you can hear footsteps approaching the sand, they always say, about a mile away, if you really listen. So the whole thing was nobody must speak, no sound must be made. So we sat in the military vehicle in complete silence for about the first half hour. I was struggling to breathe because I was breathing so shallowly. There was sudden this noise which was coming from the car behind us, which was another military vehicle accompanying us. And we realised that all the soldiers were going like that, really, but like comedy loud snoring. And I was just about to say to our driver, this is obviously a serious problem, when he started doing the same. So seriously, me and my cameraman sat there, and because it was Gaddafi's men and we didn't really want to complain, we didn't really know how to wake them all up. So all their troops were snoring away. Clearly nobody was going to appear on the horizon at night with all this snoring. So eventually I had to put my hand on one of their shoulders and say, I'm so sorry. Do you mind? It's just that everybody's snoring really loudly and we're not going to see any migrants at this rate. So anyway, eventually we did see some migrants. It wasn't enjoyable at that point. It was extremely disturbing. Not the way that Gaddafi's men treated them, but just the fact that they were lost in the middle of the desert and one more day and they would have been dead. And during that journey, we found dead bodies just littering the desert. And they were young guys who quite often had an empty water bottle in their hand. And they would be told at the beginning of the journey, or you need just a couple of litres of water, carry on walking north and you'll be fine. You know, if you are able to navigate by the moon, just carry on straight walking north and you'll get to the other end of the desert. And they didn't realise because they had no maps and they'd never really studied it. It ain't a 2-day walk, is it, across the Sahara? So that was upsetting.
It all feeds into your book, Dictatorland, which is really about Africa's worst excesses and the complicity of the West. And you take different countries and different leaders and examine them. Mm-hmm. Some absolutely wonderful stories in there. And I don't know which ones to choose, in fact, for you to go into, because they're all so great.
Well, choose one that I can remember, for a start.
Well, I do love Equatorial Guinea.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us about Obiang and his excesses?
Yes. I mean, it was funny because Equatorial Guinea was not originally one of those I was going to do, you know, and one of the difficulties in writing a book like this is obviously you could spend the rest of your life writing a book about Africa, and it's important what you decide to leave out as well as what you decide to leave in. My threshold really for being in the book as a country or as a dictator was that you had to have made yourself very wealthy from the natural resources of that country. So I look at oil and gold and diamonds and cocoa. Equatorial Guinea is right up there for oil. So I didn't know very much about it. A tiny country, you know, it's like a little fragment. It's so small. And then I started researching it and I just thought, this is the most extraordinary country, because you can feel all the way back to colonial times. It was a Spanish colony. When the Spanish left, they basically put somebody into power, Macias, and they put him in there because they thought that he was probably quite a good thing. He seemed quite popular. The locals would sort of rally around him and he seemed to have a bit of support. And they didn't know that he was literally insane. I'll tell you very briefly, one of the reasons that they thought, well, he's a very popular man, is they realised that in the courts in the capital, this man was quite popular. People were coming up to him, shaking his hands. He had little crowds around him, people were hugging him. And he was a translator, and they thought, you know, this guy's such a popular translator, he's fantastic. And then they discovered later the reason that he was so popular was that he didn't translate the facts of what was going on in court. He translated the facts according to whoever paid him the most money. So if you bribed him the most, he would translate in your favour. If somebody else bribed him more, he would translate in their favour. So he was utterly corrupt from the start. Macias ended up, he killed something like a third of the population of Equatorial Guinea. It's difficult to put a figure on it because so many people left the country, they fled at the time. But some of those people, he killed himself with his own bare hand, throwing them out of windows. I mean, he had a terrible rage. And eventually he was executed by his own nephew, Obiang. And Obiang, this all sounds like ancient history, but Obiang is still the president today of Equatorial Guinea. And Obiang has made himself phenomenally wealthy. If you see his son, and I would urge people just to go and Google his son, Teodoro. Teodoro is a guy who is phenomenally wealthy, and he is your archetypal playboy. And he's more of a playboy than any of Gaddafi's sons or anybody you've ever seen before, I guarantee you. And he's, he has a whole collection of Ferraris. And rather oddly, he got totally into Michael Jackson. So the dictator's son got so into Michael Jackson that he started spending huge volumes of money on paraphernalia to do with Michael Jackson. So he bought the famous bejeweled glove, which Michael Jackson used to wear when he was singing. Just that single one, diamond encrusted. He's got various of his suits and his hats. And so he could set up his own museum if he wanted to. And he used to keep some of it in his house in Malibu in the United States. And at one stage, even the American government, who entertained this man because his father's oil rich and supplies America with oil, even they lost patience and said, listen, this money clearly comes from corruption. And so they decided they would go and raid his house one day. And unfortunately, Teodoro got wind of this just before the Americans came in, before the FBI raided. So he managed to get all his stuff out, all his Michael Jackson paraphernalia.
Including the white glove?
Including the glove. And they put it all on a plane and managed to get it off to Paris before it was then taken from Paris to the next stop. But you can imagine, I mean, what kind of man would think the most important moment in this FBI raid is that I get the Michael Jackson stuff out as quickly as I can. But he did too. So the FBI wanted him in the States. The French authorities confiscated his property, which was loads of Ferraris and a huge house in the middle of Paris. I think the Spanish want him. He's practically wanted everywhere in the world. And yet this young man is supposedly the next president of Equatorial Guinea.
It's quite shocking, isn't it? And I mean, these stories continue. You focus on a lot of different countries. Which would be your favourite?
Well, it is a good question, but favourite to visit or favourite to write about are two rather different things. I've got to say, been to several of the countries that I've written about, and I would love to go to Equatorial Guinea. I almost certainly wouldn't get in now. I was struggling before because I tried to. But now, they very quickly research what your background is, and if you've written a book called Dictatorland, they've got a sense of where you're coming from. So it's difficult to go. The other place I'd really like to go is Sao Tome, which is a small former Portuguese island off the coast of Angola. And I would absolutely love to go there. So this is the place where they have amazing cocoa fields, where Cadbury's used to have their source of cocoa back in the very early 1900s until there was a big scandal, which I write about in Dictatorland. But Sao Tome would be a sensational place to go. Small island, like a steam room with huge purple mountains. The good thing is very few people visit. It's still slightly undiscovered. I mean, rather annoyingly, I've got to say, the other day my agent said, we've booked a holiday in this show. We're going to Sao Tome. And I thought, no, she's going before me. How dare you go before me? But it's one of those places where you can still, I think, feel as though you've gone back in history. You've gone back through time. It's nothing to celebrate in the sense that it was basically where cocoa slaves were still working up until the early 1900s. So under terrible conditions of forced labour. But, you know, those were, you know, a century on or whatever. And I think I'd just love to go and see some of the old colonial buildings and some of the fact that it's just so far away from anywhere else in Africa that you can get to, and that I love the fact that it still speaks Portuguese.
Mm. Now, of course, French is spoken in a lot of Africa, including in Ivory Coast. And you write about that too.
Yeah, and I spent quite a bit of time in Ivory Coast. It's another place where you can, if we're talking holidays for a moment, you can go to Ivory Coast. And I thought it was fantastic. I think writing about Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was the president there, it's funny because in the Francophile world, if you mention him, people think he's fantastic. I went to stay with some people in Paris whilst I was writing this book, and they said, are you putting Félix in? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, he's in there. And they said, wasn't he? He was a great man. And I said, I mean, he was a dictator and he was corrupt, but he kept the peace there for 30-odd years. So in comparison with lots of other dictators around at the time, he was a good thing, a benevolent dictator, if you like. And so I'm glad I included him in the book, but people think he shouldn't be in the book. And yet I think just because he did some good things as well and held the peace. But I think it's good to have a whole flavour, a full cross-section of different types of dictator, because they're not all bad. He was a genius at holding on to power, Félix Houphouët-Boigny. You know, he's something that one of the reasons I found him fascinating at the beginning was because actually the French did a clever thing with him, which was that they realised he was a very erudite man and also very popular, and that also he was an operator, he was a brilliant political operator. So that when they started taking, they used him as a representative of the African colonies in the Parliament in Paris. And so not only did he have a seat in the Parliament in Paris, he also became part of the cabinet. So, you know, here's a man who was a French-speaking black African who was there in the cabinet helping make decisions in Paris in the 1950s and 60s. And, you know, if you compare what was happening in America in terms of black rights at the time, you think how forward-thinking of the French, in that respect at least.
Mm. Now, one of the themes that seems to run through it is that a lot of these dictators were actually certifiably mad.
Yes. There are a number of them. We go back to Macias from Equatorial Guinea. And Macias, you're right, he was mad, and he exacerbated that by taking a whole load of hallucinogenic drugs.
In the Congo, too, though. If you look
in the Congo. Well, yeah. Mobutu. I mean, Mobutu, it's interesting, isn't it? Because he was phenomenally clever, which is another trait a lot of these people have. And it's interesting that when you're researching them, I developed a sort of respect is too strong a word, but I was, maybe it isn't. I respected him in the sense that if you can hold on to power in a place like Congo, some of it is through awful killing, torture, imprisonment. Other is through very astute politics. On the world stage, Mobutu was quite extraordinary to behold. You know, he kept Kissinger at bay. He kept Kissinger in his circle of close acquaintances, friends, kept America on side all the way through. Despite his appalling behaviour against Angola and against his own people, he managed to persuade America to turn a blind eye and to deal with him all the way through and to carry on pumping money into his regime when actually he and his cronies were just looting it, constantly looting it. But they carried on, and America would convince the World Bank to give him more money, convince the IMF to give him more money. So I've got a respect for Mobutu, and I think he's really well worth reading about because he's one of those we got a different perspective perhaps in the United Kingdom and America about from the press here. And this isn't just a champagne-swilling, good-time boy who ruled with an iron fist. This is somebody who was an operator. And actually, you know, there are plenty of people who are leaders of countries at the moment in the world who would take a leaf out of his book in terms of his political chicanery.
How culpable is the West in all of this?
Well, the West is culpable and continues to be culpable. So on two very broad levels. First of all, in terms of what we did in pre-colonial times. And this is sort of well-trodden territory, so I won't go through it again. But it's one of those, when I started writing this book, people would say, how much were we responsible? How much led into the first wave of dictators? And the answer is very much so. And very clearly, when I've just described Equatorial Guinea, for instance, the Spanish basically gave power to the guy Messias because they thought they could control him. Then he turned out to be insane. But, you know, more closely, perhaps, we would look at Nigeria and say, a country that didn't exist before we were there. If you push together, force together so many disparate tribes with disparate aims and disparate value systems, and you push them all together and assume that they will coalesce and form a unified country, that clearly, looking back on it, easy with hindsight perhaps, but it wasn't going to work. And to imagine you can just transfer that into some kind of parliamentary democracy and that would work, again, is far-fetched. So it's this thing, isn't it, called, it's a captured state theory, in the sense that a number of these colonial states were seen as captured by us, by the Europeans, and that we ruled them with an iron rod, more or less. And that when we ruled through the centre, there weren't elections, and we ruled in a particular style that when we then handed over, the next generation, the dictators in many of these countries, sadly, came in, and that was the lesson that they'd received, that this is how you run. You run from the centre and you rule with an iron rod. Mm. So in that level, there was a continuation of that theme. And now how culpable? Well, of course, now it's all about resources. So you've got to ask yourself, why don't the Americans ever complain about Obiang from Equatorial Guinea, who I was describing? Why don't we intervene in Congo more heavily than... I'm not saying boots on the ground diplomatically. We never see anything about in the news about what's happening there at the moment, or unless you really dig around for it. But I would say particularly it's interesting that Equatorial Guinea and America and the way that they get a good, cheap oil deal out of Equatorial Guinea, and so besotted are they with those oil deals, that Obiang was invited to the White House. And you can see him standing there next to Obama, and you think, my God, Obama, a man of principle. But even he realised that there was something financial which, unfortunately, had to be given a front seat next to human rights.
Why do you think that Africa is more prone to having dictators rather than functioning democracies?
No, I'm not sure it is more prone, actually. I think that there was... there aren't as many now, obviously, as immediately after, during the immediate post-colonial era. So I'm not sure it is more prone. Why is it prone? It's prone, in some ways, these are strong men were the only ways of holding these countries together. So again, if you think about Nigeria, the idea that you've got a Muslim north and a mainly Christian south, if you have a straightforward proportional representation, all singing, all dancing, super democratic parliament, it probably ain't going to work because... actually, some of these are positions that some of the tribes would take, and some of the... and when I talk about tribes, by the way, I'm talking about... I'm a Lancastrian. It's my tribe is from Lancashire in the British Isles. So I'm first Lancastrian. I'm second a British person. I'm third a European, you know. But the,
for much longer. Carry on.
So that's me, Lancastrian first, you know, and then British and then European. So there are lots of things that make me, I can link together with a Yorkshireman. I have no problem with that because we have a common set of themes and values, whatever. But I think if there's such a diversity of values and there are such animosities between rival tribes, the idea that you can bring those together and just say, let's forget all about that now, let's move on and all this will be fine because that's the way we voted, that won't work. And when one group get in, the way that they traditionally would think is to prevent the other group getting in at any time in the near future, we are going to have to fill our parliament with our own Lancastrians, if you like, to make sure nobody else comes close to power. And we will do that by fixing elections, giving top jobs to our people. You know, and we've seen that, the situation across Africa. So you, once you get into power, you will hold on to it at all costs because you will take the view that if you were to lose power to your rival tribe, they will come in and they will most definitely do the same to you. So you do it before they do it to you. My sort of specialism is Africa, but obviously it's happened at other places in the world, in South America too.
Yeah, absolutely. So what hope then for the continent?
I mean, I'm full of hope, funnily enough. We all talk about China going into Africa at the moment. And one of the reasons that the Africans are so keen, some of the countries in Africa are so keen on having the Chinese is because there are no strings attached with the Chinese. They will not say, we want to scrutinise your human rights record. We will withdraw funding if you don't do this, that and the other. That is no good at all. But in the long term, what the Chinese are doing is building or helping to build, financing an infrastructure. And that was one of the legacies of colonial times, which was useful. And that building of infrastructure, which is happening now in many countries across Africa, has got to be a good thing. You were talking about Brexit earlier. I hold this optimism that actually, if we are out of Europe, if Britain is out, the one positive thing is that we can say, look, let's, why don't we open ourselves up to even more migrants? You'll think I'm a nutter now, but even more. But they don't have to be European. Let's take them from Africa and let's take them from China and South America. So we could be even more multinational. And so I would hope that we are going to attract more Africans to come here and to learn and that they will go back and take those skills with them. And, you know, it's a long, slow slog. But I think Africa is looking up generally.
Well, your book, Dictatorland, is fabulous and does show us the worst excesses.
Yeah. You know, and that's what I feel quite bad about, because people say, oh, it's terribly negative. And it is, because that's the theme that I chose. You know, I might do part two, which would be looking at what's coming up in the future and how positive that can be. But actually, you know, I was looking at dictators, so automatically it tends to be negative.
But it's a cracking good read. Paul Kenyon, thank you so much. Paul Kenyon's book, Dictatorland, is published by Head of Zeus. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Sarah Miles and Mirjana Legrasta. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.